the been thinking about McDonald's all day, can't get it off my mind. I can already taste it. Ooh, got my mind on my mouth and my mouth ready for some Mickey D's deal.
There's a deal for every moment at McDonald's.
Right now, get two of your favorites for just $3.50. Mix and match a classic McChicken, a hot and spicy McChicken, or a juicy McDouble. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Animation fans, and welcome once again to the AFA podcast, the official podcast for animation for adults.com. My name is Rachel, and joining me today is Dan. Hey!
Hi.
Hi. And as hey. Well, and Evan.
Hi, guys.
Hey. And today we're going to be doing something we haven't done in a while, actually, but I remember we've really enjoyed recording these episodes and putting them out to you guys. We are doing a commentary episode today. So it's kind of going to be doing like a little bit of a combination between a film deep dive and also just it's us watching the movie along with you and just talking about what we know about this film in particular and thoughts on particular moments and scenes and yeah, so I'm really excited to get back into this particular style of episode, especially today because we are going to be doing the film of choice is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, and that is Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I've been wanting to do for a little bit, but just...
The most generic movie you can hope to watch.
Yes. Yes, there's nothing special about this movie at all. It's the most generic, like you said, the most generic one in Disney's lineup. Absolutely not. But yeah, we will get into the many reasons why it is the exact opposite of that as we get into
an absolute cookie cutter movie, if there ever was one.
Love the sarcasm.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. That's a great way to start us off with this commentary. But yeah, before we get into the film proper, let's just start with our, like we do in our film deep dives. Let's kind of go around and at least our surface thoughts about the film in question that we are about to watch and how we were introduced to it. Evan, how about we start with you this week and how were you introduced to the film?
I think it was a while back. First time I saw it, I was probably like 6 or 7. I think I was at daycare, like watching it on one of those like old VHS players or whatever. Mm-hmm. Didn't know it at the time, but it was probably my first proper introduction or at least like half introduction to adult content, mm-hmm. masked as children's content. And I'm sure Rachel and Dan, both of you can speak to that too. But yeah, it was one of those seminal films that I'll always remember. Got a lot of things to say about it as we dive in.
Mm-hmm. I'm particularly excited to hear your thoughts on it. And how about you, Dan?
I was in the pocket for some. I was similar age to Evan. I was 6 when this was released. In mm-hmm. fact, mm-hmm. I remember the release vividly because it was around the age when I first started noticing movie releases. And like, I was the perfect, you know, like target audience, like mom and dad to take you to see this movie, mm-hmm. age. So I had like sticker albums, like a sing-along, read-along tape mm-hmm. for this. I used to listen to like Topsy-Turvy in my little Walkman, like again and again and again on cassette. And then I saw it on release and it was a Disney movie. I was completely satisfied. I was satisfied with Pocahontas, so I wasn't a picky, like Disney, you know, audience member.
Yeah, like pushing up the bridge of your glasses, like this is nothing compared to The Lion King.
I was absolutely 100% in on it. And actually, I remember this was like one of the first instances when I was curious about how animation was made. I remember there was a special on TV about the making of, and I turned to my dad and I said, is this, how do they film this? Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, it's one picture. And then I'm like, I know how animation works. I know there's one picture that's slightly different from the next, but like, it was the first time. And then my dad was like, well, yeah. And I was like, yeah, so how about the backgrounds? Like, is it like a giant flip book? Mm-hmm. And they just like stick a camera nearby and like they have someone who's really good at flipping flip books. And my dad was like, no, they have cells. And he started to explain it to me and I kind of got it. It was something I was a conscious human when it was released, let's mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but you know, over the years, I caught it, like, it was on the Disney Channel like about 15 years ago. And I caught it like 10 minutes in and I started watching it and I was just, we'll get into it, but like I was confounded. I wasn't like so much entertained, it's more just like absolutely baffled about how how it had been made, and particularly in this way. But having seen it since then, I'm very curious how I'm going to react to it now.
Yeah, so you're revisiting this film after a long time. Like this is not something that you've seen recently. This is something that you
you've seen parts of it somewhat recently, right? At least.
Yeah. I'll kind of very briefly go into the story of how I kind of got reintroduced to watching this movie again, because of all the Disney films, at least a good majority of them, like the ones that came out in this era, it's the one, or at least in that particular era of the 90s, it's the one I've seen the least. Not because I don't like it, it's because I don't know if it's just one of those movies you just have to be in the right mood for to watch it. But it was this, I found this movie was on display at work, believe it or not. I was working my job in the hospital and going by the COVID-19 vaccination clinic, which they have a lot of, you know, younger kids, you know, 12 and over coming in to get their vaccine shots. And they've been playing, as you know, over the course of this time, they've been playing like nonstop, like Disney and Pixar movies. And recently, I would say just within this week, they had Hunchback of Notre Dame on the screen, in the big like projector screen in the waiting area, which surprised me for sure. But I'm just like, man, I remember that movie. It was really like the one word I get whenever I think of this movie is just epic, big, huge, monument.
Good word.
I mean, in the case of the namesake of the actual Notre Dame Cathedral, monumental, you know? It's just like, it's...
I mean, the poster alone is like, I remember the poster being so epic. I remember seeing the poster in the cinema, like before, you know, like a few months before it was released, and just being like, what is that? It's like the most epic thing. It's just ultra like high angle shot, like looking down at the bells and then looking through the cathedral, and it's like you can see like the Seine like stretching away into the horizon. Like it's so epic is a word.
And I also have some fondness in terms of the fact that, you know, I also can associate it with, you know, with an actual location, you know, which was the Notre Dame Cathedral, because, you know, during my time in England, which is probably, I think, when I actually had a chance to see the movie in theaters, I got a chance to actually go to Notre Dame.
That's a good point. Yeah, I visited Notre Dame, like, I think the year that it came out as well. So I was particularly like enchanted as a kid by that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The directors visited it too. Gary Truesdell and
Kurt Wise.
Yeah. I guess that goes without saying. But you look at the intricacy of the set design. I don't know what the proper term for it is in animation. They definitely did their homework.
I believe they just call it art direction, or sometimes nowadays I have also heard like production design also being used.
But yeah.
So yeah, Gary Trousdale and Kirk Wise, directors of Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's what we really need to say, based on the classic Victor Hugo, well, very much based off an idea told to a guy, remembered by someone at Disney.
Well, to be fair, if they had tried to be more of a faithful adaptation of the book, it would have been definitely not a Disney, you know, story, because it's like, and then everyone died.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I mean.
Okay, but should we decide? Because I think that's all going to come up. Like,
Yeah. Okay. But I think, unless there's anything else you guys want to get out before we actually start the movie proper, because I've got it all queued up and ready to go.
I want to hear this. I want to hear this Mencken score again.
On three. 1, 2, 3, go.
Okay, so we have like 10 seconds of like nothing.
Yeah, it's like
overture.
It's quiet.
A choir faintly in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have the clap. I miss this logo.
Yeah.
Me too.
I miss this one.
I mean, the new one's okay, but it's I don't know. There's just something about that design, that logo design is just really snazzy.
Come on. That's how you start a movie.
Yeah, Rachel, you said that this is an epic film, and right from the get-go, you've got that dramatic choir music.
Mm-hmm. And also the shot, too, where you just see the upper part of the cathedral, which is standing over the clouds, which is just gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Love the music in this film.
I think probably.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
No.
I'm just going to say this is some of my favorite music in the Disney movies, period. So there. My piece is done.
I'm going to go out on not a limb. I think it might be one of. It might be Mencken's best score.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Pocahontas, Dan. I think that no doubt you know this, but he also did the score for that, I think, too. And then the co-composer, Stephen Schwartz, went on to do the music and lyrics for The Prince of Egypt.
That makes a lot of sense.
Which also has a really good score, right? Yeah. Okay. So you can kind of see the connection there.
Let me double check and make sure I'm lined up with you guys, because I'm at 2 minutes and 9 seconds. So where are you guys at?
The thing isn't actually
going for me. Safe Passage into Paris just happened.
Yeah. Frollo's riding up on his horse.
There he is.
Yeah.
Giant Frisian horse.
That horse has got some long hair.
Almost looks like not really a Clydesdale, but just like that's normally a workhorse.
Yeah. Yes. So I think this is like, do you know what's crazy about this already is that I think Disney would not open a film like this nowadays.
Mm-hmm. No.
It's just going for, funny you mentioned Prince of Egypt, it's going for, you know, shamelessly serious.
Yeah.
Yeah, like there's nothing
dramatic.
This is all drama right here.
Yeah, it's unabashedly grim, and we've got a murder on screen taking place or unfolding in front of us right now. You know, you definitely wouldn't see that today.
Mm-mm.
man.
In a kid's film, no less.
No, yeah.
So this for me is the story of this movie. Is yeah, no, that's grim. Her smacking the head on the.
And then she's just dead. And then of course we get Frollo here. He's holding about a baby, and look the way he holds this baby, like. Wah!
He's only like
no one had to think that up. Like, okay, how would you drop a baby in a well? Like, that's just awful.
Yeah, going near religion, which is something I don't think Disney would do nowadays.
Oh no, I think this is the only time, even beforehand, like with some of their other earlier films, they didn't dare tread that ground for fear of, you know, reprisal. But they. Mm-hmm. Said, you know what? We're an established studio. We've had a ton of hits. Let's take some risks.
Well, this is exactly the thing. Like, this is like a year after Pocahontas,
mm-hmm.
or 2 years after Pocahontas. So it's like they're trying to go for the Oscar, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean. Beauty and the Beast at this point had already been nominated for a Best Picture,
mm-hmm.
which again changed how animation was seen in the eyes, at least in part of that community. And so they're like, okay, maybe if we really go balls to the wall.
Mm-hmm. And it's the dream team of, you know, Menken and Trousdale and Wise, who were like Beauty and the Beast's crew.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually recently, because you know we're doing this for the 25th anniversary,
mm-hmm.
there was recently a great article by Josh Spiegel on Slash Film that was like an oral history of mm-hmm. Hunchback. And he interviewed a bunch of, you know, everyone who was involved. And I really recommend it.
But
the story for me of this film is the constant tension between the film that could have been, you know, like a PG-13 adult movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And all of the obligations of a Disney movie.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah, and it's incredibly bipolar.
This climax right here, I mean, the title is just... The music and everything is working so well together.
It gives me chills every single time I watch it. And you know the funny story?
Yeah, no.
I just want to mention, like, because I remember, I do faintly remember seeing this movie in theaters with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, when, you know, back when we had VHS tapes, they would make sure that we, you know, if we there was a film that would come out VHS that I really liked, or my brother really likes, we would get it and we would watch it, you know, ad infinitum. But oddly enough, this was the film that never came into our film library on VHS. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there was a reason for that.
I mean, so the reason I think is another interesting reason is, yeah, it's not really a video movie because, like, it's not one that the family comes out of feeling uplifted and, you know.
At least not in the usual Disney way. I mean, there is a happy ending to this and we'll get there later, but you've gone through some pretty hard hitting stuff to get there. And it's not necessarily, and it doesn't necessarily resolve everything that you've seen.
Yeah. The way that I don't want to say too much.
There it is.
Yep. Now, this was some interesting comic relief, and we'll kind of get there at least when we get to the other, when we see the other side of this particular comic relief. But for a while, I had an opinion on these guys in terms of what they actually were. But I'm still kind of going back and forth on whether I believe it or not.
Oh, I think it's... Well, go on.
That the idea that these guys were in Quasi's head more than actually being actual characters. But no, yes. The film does confirm, like, no, yeah, especially in the climax of the movie that these they do just animate on their own. But especially in the earlier parts of the movie, it's just like, are they just in his head? And that's just how he
I prefer to see it that way.
Yeah.
Even if they do, you know, like affect the fight at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I much prefer to see them that way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember that the one gargoyle, like the one that would almost consistently get a laugh out of me of these three characters is the older lady one. Laverne, I believe is her name. That's what are their names? Hugo's the one that's the pig looking one.
The what's his name? The actor, Jason
Alexander. Seinfeld. Oh yeah.
Isn't Alexander, yeah. Which is kind of the thing, right? Like that's the thing with this movie where they go like, okay, we've got the formula by now. We take, you know, one part Mencken and you know, before obviously departed Ashman, you know, a TV star that's kind of about to break but not quite, and then you know. A few more serious actors and some Broadway people, and you know, it seems like it feels like the setup they think is like, oh, this can't lose, and then the thematic stuff, you know, basically this film is at odds, I think, with its dramatics, with its themes. Where every time it is about to hit like a pure emotional touching moment, it undercuts itself with humor that it feels obligated to drop in.
Yeah.
To distract you from the fact that it's about what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think is the most interesting thing about the film for me, where it feels like it's trying to, you know, what's that saying? Cut off its nose to spite its face. You know, it's
Yeah, like case in point, we had the scene that was, you know, introducing those three comic relief characters, and now, you know, as soon as Frollo enters the room, it's just like all life. Like the room gets colder when he steps into the scene. And that's, it's hard to, yeah, like you said, it's clashes when you have scenes with the gargoyles and then all of a sudden Frollo's in the room. And it's just like, okay, it feels like these are characters from two completely different movies.
Oh, well, Frollo is just like the most, I mean, like in terms of his proportion, you know, like the most like human character. It's strange that he's in the same movie as a gargoyle. Sure.
I know, exactly. Like, it's just, it almost, I wouldn't say quite tonal dissonance, but almost there.
No, I think that's the word that, you know, that sums up the movie. And I'm interested in, like, wondering if that was ever the intention, whether they ever wanted to just do a more straightforward movie, or whether it was meddling that led to...
I did hear, and take this with a grain of salt, Dan, that there were a lot of concerns about the MPAA and keeping that G rating. That might kind of explain why the film is so like self-conscious, right? And kind of retracts, you know, constantly into those moments of like more juvenile, like comic behavior. Because at the time, I guess they were kind of concerned that it just wouldn't sell well in theaters if they were kind of touting this PG or even PG-13 film. You know, because that wasn't the association you made with animation, you know, I mean, like families were supposed to go see this stuff and it just wasn't going to happen if they couldn't keep that G rating. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember, listening to commentary about like say even other films like, The Black Cauldron when that was getting made, because that's also some pretty heavy, like source material that they were trying to adapt. But then of course they, see, like, okay, if we try to make it the way we are, like, this will be the first R-rated Disney film. And, of course, it got chopped up and gone through the ringer so it ended up the way it is. But I imagine they had the exact same fears with this one because of the dark source material.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is, I think, something of a tragedy with, I guess, the situation. You know, it's something of a tragedy. I don't want to speak for anyone who was involved mm-hmm. with the film, mm-hmm. but for me, the tragedy seems to be the only place we can make this movie is the place where audiences are expecting a four quadrant film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, it just feels to me like I can feel like artists on this film just wanting to make, like we're saying, like the PG-13 version.
Yeah.
The film would have been better for it. I think that we're all kind of agreed on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It would have had a lot more freedom. Oh, I love the song. Oh my God. Yeah. He's such a good singer too. Like, yeah. Holy. Like, I remember rewatching this. Voice. Yeah, like I was rewatching, like, he has the voice of an angel, this guy. I love him. And of course, beautiful, beautiful shots of the church.
The artwork of this film is incredible. I think for a long time, the art of this book was, you know, very sought after. And I think we had it at university, and pouring over the layouts is just stunning. Very, very, very detailed background work in this film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of like there's attention to the background. Well, like, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. Oh, it's a nice CG shot here.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I remember this in the trailer.
James Baxter. Nice.
Oh, that's James Baxter. Gotta love him. But I kind of like the idea with that there's such a heavy emphasis on the backgrounds, and especially even like in the town of, you know, in Paris, because, yeah, especially tying in with the song sequence going on right now, is the idea that, you know, he's looking at the city from Notre Dame, and he's observed it all his life. And so he gets, you know, all the nooks and crannies, the different, you know, the people living out in the town, mm-hmm. in the city. And it's just like, I like that kind of, that ties together thematically.
I used to, as a kid, love the Spider-Man vibe as well.
Yeah.
Where he was just like not afraid of falling off. Because yeah. He's so familiar with jumping around.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And him Spider-Manning all over Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And then after, I believe, okay, I think you guys are still a little bit ahead of me, but we're being introduced to the third Phoebus. Main character, Phoebus. Yeah. I actually really love him as a side character.
He's funny. Kevin Klein. There are, I mean, we'll see him in a sec, but there are a lot of like dad jokes, like little puns, like blink or you miss it. But they're kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is yeah. So okay, Dinesh is getting introduced to Phoebus, also Esmeralda.
Oh, that's another thing that's strange about this film.
What?
It's the constant use of what is now effectively, to my ears, a slur. You know, I'll say it once. How they refer to Esmeralda. I'm not going to say it, actually. Just they call her. You know, a slur for mm-hmm. for traveling folk.
Yeah, yeah, I'm yeah. They use it a lot in this movie.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the movie says it, so I guess, you know.
Oh, I love this. Yes, Achilles, sit. The only horse who sits on command. But you know, yeah, they refer to her that, like, they refer to all the
I think we can say the word. I'm not yeah. I'm not trying to police it, but you know, like what I'm saying is it's again and like another sort of facet of the film that I feel like Disney just wouldn't go near nowadays. Like depicting an actual race and their discrimination being not a metaphor, just a one-to-one. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you know. These people are discriminated against, simply. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's active discrimination, too. And it's like throughout the movie.
See, by this point as well, they were getting more, like, there you can see ambitious with, like, camera moves and layered backgrounds, because they were much more used with using computer compositing, basically, to produce lots of multiplane.
Oh, I remember this scene. Oh, guess what? There's torture going on in here, guys.
Yeah.
Active torture.
It's a really great moment of characterization for Frollo, right, though? Like, Phoebus walks in and Frollo's telling the torturer, "Oh, wait between lashes," so he can, like, feel the pain, you know? They're just, like, putting in these little bits to show us how vile he really is, I guess.
And not to mention the fact that how much is on the line for Phoebus, too, because...
Exactly.
He mentions previous captain of the guard, and then you hear the crack of the whip, and you're just like, "Oh, god damn it!"
Yeah,
that's he finds himself in it working for an interesting person. That he's definitely, like, you can see the look on Phoebus's face the entire time he's having this conversation. Like, we've already gotten the gist of the fact that he does not approve of this at all. He's here because he has to be, but he does not approve of Frollo or his ideas of
maybe I'm reaching too far with this, but you might be able to almost characterize them as foils, because they're both, you know, enforcers or upholders of the law, right? But totally opposite to each other, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Phoebus is like very morally upright, and Frollo's not, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see that in the color palette too. I don't know, maybe I'm just like
No, the filmmaking I think it's quite sophisticated. Like,
yeah.
Particularly compared to the previous few movies.
Mm-hmm. Ah, here comes the Festival of Fools, and Quasimodo's taking the leap to actually get involved.
This is the song that was on my cassette, and I used to listen to before watching the movie, just going like, "What is this gonna be?"
I mean, it's pretty, again, like, much like the previous, some of the previous songs, like especially the opening track, like, you still get that sense of, like, epic scale.
Lots of CG crowd workers here. That was quite revolutionary, I think, for the time.
I remember seeing this sequence in the trailers a lot. That might be why it stuck in your head too, Dan. You know, I think they were really trying to showcase the visual splendor of the film that we're seeing in this scene. And, you know, the music's fun too.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, there's a lot of great visual gags in this sequence alone, because of the fact that you're getting to see all these really strange strange acts and performers come on screen. Yeah, like right there, like you got the dogs walking the people. And, the actor for Clopin, I believe, is the name of the character we see throughout the film, kind of like semi-narrating it. His singing is just amazing.
It is. Well, I think he was a Broadway star, wasn't he? I forget the guy's name, but like, he was actually a stage actor, and they brought him in for this.
I can see it.
Yeah.
For sure. My god. Yeah, I remember in the trailers they played a lot of bits of animation from this particular sequence.
Yeah. Was this, you guys are way better on your history than me. Was this one of the first times that they, like, used CG assets? Because you see, like, the people in the background, and sometimes they're hand drawn, sometimes they're like 3D.
I think it was. I believe it was.
Well, at least in terms of characters, I'm not sure. Like, I know Disney had been already dabbling with a bunch of, like, computer generated effects for, like, scenes and such.
Yeah.
But I think that's the first time that they used it for, like, a crowd. Oh, I love this bit of animation where she just comes in. Oh, I'd forgotten about that cut to Frollo there.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Man. Oh my god. What? Oh no. Honey, never do that again.
Nothing ambiguous going on.
Oh yeah. No. Like
lots of winking. They paid a lot of attention to animate that.
Oh, they yeah. certainly did. Like Esmeralda is like easily one of the best animated characters in this movie.
Because all the guys at the studio.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my god.
wanted to go to watch pole dancers for reference. No, I'm doing work.
No, seriously, I'm doing work.
So this sequence I find fascinating when you think about what's happening with the tone. It's setting up, it's again that word like Rach, it's the dissonance. Right. Where it's like, yeah. Okay, this is we're invested in him. We're feeling like, okay, this is we're like, oh, this is kind of fun for them, but I don't know if I'm having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
like watching this.
Good point.
And then it leads up to this like moment of sort of like humiliation, public humiliation.
Oh yeah.
And you can feel, so like this is, I can remember this from like from when I was, so this movie on TV, where it's quite it's getting quite emotional and intense.
Oh god, yeah.
Because yep. he's being crowned like King of Fools, and it's like, okay, this is like a parade, so, and it's going really like Broadway with the actual music. Mm-hmm. And but like in terms of the story, you're sort of like, okay, this is, okay, is he being accepted by them? Like, it's still yeah, uneasy.
Exactly.
I'm not just, it's not like the arrival of Prince Ali, where I'm like, oh, no, this is yeah. just yeah. fun.
Well, especially with Frollo in the background, because he's, you know, he's really, I'd like that, the fact that he just cried, it was just, that just broke my heart a little bit, because, I mean, especially when you have supposedly these good things going for him, Frollo is still right there looking at him. He's in trouble. He's in big yeah. trouble. So...
But this will be the first time he's had any sort of outside human contact, right?
Yeah, so maybe that's just like outside of Frollo himself. Yeah. Outside of Frollo himself.
Exactly. It's the only world he's known. But yeah, you're spot on, Rachel.
And then, of course, now we have these jackass, the jackass guards. They're the ones who start throwing vegetables.
Screw these guys.
Yeah, I know. And they're Frollo's guys. So they're, everyone already kind of hates them. Yeah, they're instigating. And then, unfortunately, the crowd lemming mentality starts breaking out.
And it's, this is horrific. So, like.
Yeah, I remember watching this. It starts getting. What the fudge?
The color red starts coming in. So you'll notice, yeah. like, the background, the sky's getting a bit redder.
Mm-hmm. yeah, they're tying him down. Yeah, there's the color change. Yeah, his back breaking his shirt.
And he's being, it's so brutal. And they tied him down.
Oh.
Okay. And but now, watch this.
Oh my god.
This is the story I have to tell. This is the problem with adapting something like this. This is sort of like, you can't escape from the fact that this yeah. scene needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one character that I really despise.
Oh?
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a comic relief, like, literally one shot, two shot.
Oh, character. I think I know who you're talking about, Dan.
You know, he was in the trailer.
That one. Yeah, and we'll get there.
Gonna see him in a second.
By itself, it's kind of funny. But like in context, it's literally like someone trying to, well, it's like someone trying to like, you know, like composite like Peppa Pig's face on a dinosaur in Jurassic Park to make it less scary. It's like, it's mm-hmm. not, I understand why you think that's going to work, but it doesn't distract from the fact.
Yeah, that we just that had this main awful crux thing. Of the
story. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you, didn't I? I apologize.
No. The movie's doing its thing.
Yeah, Esmeralda's being awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yep. Why isn't she a Disney princess?
Because she's a strumpet. But genuinely, I think that might be the reason. I think, you know, there's... of course, there's... Yeah.
Yeah. That is so cool, though. I love the sense of humor that she... Like, if that was where the comic relief in this movie came from, I wouldn't have mind. You know, that's that... That stays in still in tone, right?
It feels quite, what's her name? Marion from Indiana Jones, almost.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a good comparison.
Okay, yeah, here's the comic relief you were talking about, Dan. Yep.
A stilt guy coming in the clutch.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh, this.
Yeah.
All these sound effects.
Dang it.
Yeah, so it works on its own, but yeah, like in the context of the film.
Like all these sound effects, like trying to distract from the fact that like that massive public humiliation just happened.
Yeah, and they're trying to take you out of it, aren't they? Yeah,
yeah. I think that's exactly what this sequence is.
And my biggest problem with it is that the whole point of the movie is meant to be like having empathy for someone unfortunate. So. Whenever the film like tries to make you laugh at someone's misfortune, I'm not on board.
No, absolutely.
Mm.
I think it's like, I don't know. I think it's still like, I laugh when the guards or Frollo gets like some form of comeuppance, like at the hands of Esmeralda or in Phoebus's case. But yeah, like that, just that one joke at that one old man's misfortune of just always trying to get away and always getting trapped is not good.
Oh, that was so stunning.
Oh my god. Yeah, like yeah.
And this is again the way it is actually a good story, because like the worst villain, mm-hmm. like Frodo's right
mm-hmm.
in this one instance.
Yeah.
You know, if you go out there, it'll be bad for you. You'll be humiliated. Everyone will think you're a freak. You belong in here. Yeah. And now that seems to be completely
true.
Yeah, justified. True. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But that's where we get the good bits of the story, is that maybe if that one instance it's right, but we have to, there's more to life than just that, which is what he's going to learn, especially with mm-hmm. interacting with Esmeralda.
Mm-hmm.
The inside the cathedral shots.
Yeah.
I love them.
Beautiful.
This kind of like, because everyone talks about this nowadays. It's like, oh, let's pause and like enjoy the thing, enjoy the slow down for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly one of those like moments for me. Like whenever, There are a few instances in this film where they manage to do that by just asking you to regard the I keep wanting to call it a castle, the cathedral.
Oh, I like that. I like that line. It's like she's about to say, "You son of a," he's like, "We're in a church." way to avoid the PG-13 rating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like you, again, watching this, I only just watched it earlier this afternoon and I'm watching it again. Like, yeah, there's so many opportunities this movie has to be that PG-13 movie, but it avoids every single opportunity it has to go that way because of reasons. I just like the chemistry these two have.
It's a good scene.
Mm-hmm.
It is a good scene.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is where it's okay. Claim Sanctuary. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Power Stone. Oh, hey, here comes the Archdeacon to be like, I know, Frollo, I know you're full of crap. Get out of here.
There are so many great, they are not, they're getting all the use out of every close-up of Frollo. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh God, this bit. Oh no.
Okay, I do have to say, I hate to interrupt you, Rachel, but I remember watching this when I was a kid. Uh-huh. And they think children aren't that intuitive.
Uh-huh.
I didn't fully understand what was happening, but I knew something was wrong, and I bet you guys did too.
Yeah, like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the way he's holding her, the way content. He sniffs her hair.
Bad touch. Like,
just all the kinds of bad touch.
It's insane. I think the oral history that I was reading recently mentioned that luckily, I believe, you know, in test audiences or whatever, that a lot of it just did simply go over kids' heads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, and this I think is the difference between respecting your audience and, you know, understanding what's going on. They didn't get any response from kids, which is not necessarily, you know, you guys are just proving a point just there. Like, if you're not giving an outward response, it doesn't mean to say you still don't understand what's happening.
It sticks with you in its own way.
I think that might be the thing I think that people of our generation might feel watching this, maybe, you know, or like people, you know, people who were kids when the film was released feel is like, looking back on it and realizing, oh, that was a lot more adult than I realized, particularly with Hellfire.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're definitely right, Dan. You know, like I'm sure we all have friends who love Disney just as much as we do, but this is definitely the title that you know, a lot of my buds keep coming back to and talking about for that reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
All that kind of subliminal content that went over your head. It's like, I don't know, maybe this is a bad analogy, like having a weird dream and finally understanding what it means like years later or something. You know?
That's a good analogy, I think.
No, I think that's absolutely the feeling, because it's Disney. It's like it's like putting something in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's gonna reach people.
Another beautiful song.
Oh my God. It's just banger after banger after banger with all of these songs. Like, I don't think there's really, I mean, the one that has the guard that features the gargoyles is kind of the meh one of, is the only meh song in the entire film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And moments of like, in terms of animation, like surprising restraint.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, it's just walking through the cathedral and he's like sort of watching it.
Yeah, but at the same time,
and they're letting,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, they're letting the layout and the composition and the filmmaking, like, do the work,
mm-hmm.
rather than you know, what they had been, or what they just did basically was do a Broadway banger.
Pretty, yeah.
That's a good observation, Dan. They're kind of letting the film breathe, I guess, you know. You see that a lot in, they talk about that being, like that being kind of like a pretty common convention with like the Ghibli films, but that's what makes them so magical is they take a moment to just kind of allow you to soak it all in.
Well, I believe it's an instinct that a lot of filmmakers actually really have. And
sure.
I think the reason that it gets talked about so much in animation is because Ghibli manage it. And then for people with no imagination, as animation as its own medium, go, oh, it really exists in animation. Oh, okay. Whereas I believe, you know, like watching this, you can just go like, oh, right. They just, they weren't going, we're making an animated film. They were going, we're making a film and it happens to be animated. And mm-hmm. a lot of the filmmaking is really speaking yes. to that. And it's surprisingly, you know, DreamWorks-y, like mm-hmm. Prince of Egypt as well, in yeah. terms of, you know, everything being stylized somewhat, but like all the characters being like, normally proportioned humans, and the shot design as well being it's nothing like the shot design even in like Beauty and the Beast, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where the camera is moving through space and it's really tied down to like a sense of geography as well.
Mm-hmm. Goodness, I'm noticing there's moments where we're just like, where we, oh God. it's really easy because... to get sucked in, man. It's just, I'm like, we're, because we go into something, we talk about something and then we just get sucked right in. It's just, that's the power this movie has. Oh, is that I think that's his charms in the back there. Those are computer generated too, I think, right? They look it. Yeah. They, I like that nice subtle detail.
However, the lighting is not.
Yes, it is.
The lighting itself, as it that falls on the models, is all hand drawn.
Mm-hmm. Which is good.
Which is an interesting, yeah, it's an interesting era, really, of animation where certain things were still easier to do by hand, and you know, the computer was helping in some ways.
Mm-hmm. I like this little scene of kind of getting to know a bit more about what Quasimodo's life. Like, he's named all the bells. I love that. I love that touch.
Hmm. And there's so, but the sense of scale is amazing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, not much to say at the moment, other than it's just, it's going for it. It's going for it. Okay, actually, one thing I do want to ask you, have you heard the Broadway show?
I have not.
What they did a few years ago, I think Disney actually made it, but or it was licensed by Disney. Effectively, They restaged it much more in line with the original ending.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And the score is just, you know, stunning, because the songs are sort of like slightly lengthened versions of what's in here, and
mm-hmm.
they get to be a lot more explicit with mm-hmm. With the themes.
Mm-hmm.
Well worth a listen. I really recommend it, actually.
Okay.
It's sort of, I think, for quite a few people at the moment, like their favorite iteration of a Disney version of the story.
Interesting.
Because it's basically not a Disney story.
Okay, yeah. I appreciate that joke right there. Like, what do you say? Frollo's nose is long and he wears a dress. I appreciate small bits of humor where they make fun of the big bad, especially when you know how awful he is.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, you need a little comic relief, right? Like, even like the Shakespearean tragedies always have a little bit of that. Otherwise, you're just not going to make it to the end. Like, you can't handle all that emotional weight.
No, yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Rachel.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, because I trust me, like there's some, what was an anime that I watched? It was a while ago. It was one of my anime my friends really wanted to watch. It was Kasha and Sins, I remember. It was a remake of a particular old superhero anime. It was a lot cheesier, but they really like upped the drama and seriousness of the show like crazy. And it had little to no comic relief whatsoever. It was just drama after drama after drama after drama, which, I mean, it still explored some interesting concepts, but after a while, like, I just had to take an extended break from it because it was just so many heavy emotional hits. Like, I'm tired. I am emotionally and physically tired.
Well, and you don't want that, right? They talk about, I'm sorry, Dan, go ahead.
No.
I was just saying, like, you know, they talk about compassion fatigue. You probably experience that in a film that doesn't relent at all. You know, you get to the end and that's probably where the most emotional weight is, but you're so exhausted that you just can't really absorb it or appreciate it, you know, at that point. So that's probably what the humor is there for, is to kind of cleanse your palate, so to speak.
Yeah. So, and that's, I think we were talking, yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Well, I feel what we're talking about as well is like this sense of, I mean, it's kind of in line with what Disney's doing in the 90s, which is like, you know, they're telling themselves, and, you know, many of the world's best critics are telling them, like, oh, right, you're making the best Broadway shows at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that word for me, though. It's show. It's like, well, you're putting on a show. Like, someone's getting dressed up a little bit to go to the pictures, to go to the movies, to see... see this, and you know, if you don't give them something of a show, then it's not going to be worth the price of admission. And I mean, like, even, you know, certainly some of the most bleakest films, or films that on their surface seem unrelenting, manage that. One of my favorites is actually There Will Be Blood, which on a first watch,
wonderful film,
is kind of bleak and is brutal, but the more I watch it, the more I'm just like laughing all the way through, because the timing is great, and there is definitely a funny side to it, but it's a tightrope walk, and I think that's the thing for me with this movie, is it's a tightrope walk, right?
Between, well, yeah,
but, and especially what's going on right now.
Yes.
All of this, like, this is like probably most out of convention for Disney, of, you know, doing this meet cute stuff and then he never gets the girl. Like,
yeah.
It's a weird one.
That was the ballsy choice for sure.
Yeah.
I think as a kid, the patterns of stories, even by the age of like six, were so baked in to my head that when he didn't get the girl, I was like, is that
possible? Right?
Like, what's going on?
doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I mean, we already passed by the scene where we had Quasimodo and Phoebus meet for the first time, and obviously there's, because they both care about Esmeralda a lot, that just, like, you know, there's that tension.
I believe that's what they managed in the reason they did the sequel, right?
Has anyone seen that?
He falls in love.
I did, and it was really bad. It was so bad. Like,
well, the production value was really bad at the least.
Like, Notre Dame itself, probably the cathedral itself, suffered the most, because, like, you see how grand and big it is in this movie. Like, it looks like just a regular size, like, small church in the sequel. And I'm just like, no, that's like the biggest sin you could commit. Ironically, as we get into
an actual sin.
I swear that was unintentional. I was unintentional. I swear. But in terms of the fact that they had this beautiful grand cathedral and they reduce it to just almost look like a paper cutout. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, that's definitely one front where Disney doesn't do too well most of the time, is those direct-to-video sequels. But that could be another conversation.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
This is the big moment.
Oh yeah, here we are. Rose,
big number.
Yeah, his okay. Showstopper.
So, I actually have a couple notes about this scene.
Okay. Okay.
Sure.
Go for it.
This is straight from the oral history by
sure.
By Josh Spiegel that I found. So basically, they've said like they'll never get away with anything like this again.
Mm-hmm.
So Alan Menken and Stephen Schwartz talk about like tackling it, and you know they just went for it basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is really sorry, Dan.
There's one line that the MPAA had a problem with, which is the burning desire is turning me to sin,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't like it. And they were like, "Well, we annotated it. Like, we can't." So the word "sin" there is like dropped a little bit in the mix.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And they make it. There's a cymbal crash with it.
Yeah.
But I think like, for some reason, the innuendo was enough to just get past them.
Really?
The fact that it was, you know, it forces you to engage with it. So it can effectively go over kids' heads.
Hmm.
Especially the sexual nature. It just seems like, oh, he's a villain. He wants to capture the pretty girl. You know, I think that was how I processed it when I was a kid, when I first saw it.
Yeah. Yeah, I just said, bad dude does bad things.
I knew that, I just thought he was insane.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, it's one girl. Like, why'd you?
Yeah.
Yep.
Let it get away.
Yeah. Oh my god. Oh god, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, love it with the shadows.
Yeah, it's so dramatic. There's a better word for that, but
no.
Well, the other thing that your oral history mentioned was that it's basically like a Fantasia sequence.
It is.
Oh, that is, oh, wow. Yeah.
It got closer to capturing Fantasia than Fantasia 2000 did.
They were watching Night on Bald Mountain and,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's there.
And he just passes out on the ground.
Didn't end with the joke. He got so horny, he passed out.
Oh my god.
And yeah, look at his face. I had a little trouble with the fireplace. Look at his eyes, like, oh my god.
Yeah.
He's got a horny hangover.
Oh yeah, this is also serious, the tonal things. Like, oh yeah, we're seeing more active discrimination and child in chains. Look at that. That child is in chains.
Yeah, blink and you miss it, but it's there. Pretty dark.
Uh-huh, shoving there. Yep. With people still inside it. Another Phoebus child in chains. Yeah, Phoebus is like, look at that intensity.
Mounting frustration.
Oh, yes. And then it all comes to the head.
This is the boiling point right here.
Yep. I love how Esmeralda just keeps doing the hunched over old woman with the goat for a face.
It's a good bit, and she should definitely tour.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. He lies to their faces, turns around, shuts them in when he says he's going to give and he just like, okay, we're just going to straight up murder these people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Phoebus is like, no. Wait a minute, I think that horse's hair gets longer every single time I see it.
Is this not, he's just going through a phase.
Yeah. I think
it's all switched to one side.
Yeah.
I love it. Phoebus goes to put it on the thing and he just shoves it in the water.
Yeah.
It's a waste of a good mill as well. Like, you could at least
repurpose
that.
Well,
for
it's I mean, case in point with the whole he got so horny he passed out. Frollo is if he ever was in his right mind, that's long gone now.
Yeah.
Like he's just been through his tipping point, and he's just like there's no coming back.
Voice. Who's Frollo?
Oh god. I should know this. Hold on.
Really iconic voice. He did some minor role in Beauty and the Beast, I think, didn't he?
He was the insane asylum guy.
Yes. In that movie. He had like five lines, but yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make depression. A real stab at oh my god, he was Megabyte in Reboot.
Yep.
Whoa.
Yep. I know. Did that just blow your mind or what?
That's pretty wild.
A little bit. So I'm pretty sure that he was in the 90s Tom and Jerry movie. Am I right about that? I don't think I am.
That would hurt me so much.
Wow. So this guy, Tony J.
Mm-hmm.
He beat Derek Jacobi, Ian McKellen, and Patrick Stewart for this role.
Really?
Wow.
Damn.
They preferred him to all of those guys. Which, I mean, like, in 1996, like, that's, like, you know, getting Ian McKellen or Patrick Stewart in... you know, in that role would have been amazing.
No, yeah, for sure. I don't know, if Patrick Stewart had been cast for that role, I would have had some, because I was young at the time and my family was always really into Star Trek, Next Generation. So having Captain Picard play an evil guy would have really that would have rocked my world.
Yeah. I think it would have, I think it was still a consideration that you had to take.
Yeah.
So, this feels very old Disney.
Mm-hmm.
It feels really old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. These antics.
Oh yeah, with the gargoyles. Yeah. I mean, we've cut
from the city is burning.
Yeah, the city is literally on fire.
Yeah.
They joke about that in the song coming up.
That's a Sweeney Todd song.
Yeah, but still, just like we're having a song sequence about love while Paris is on fire. Like, okay.
Yeah, this whole number right here—it's just so silly and feels so out of place. I don't know. I don't know how you guys feel out of it. I'm not a fan of this song.
I completely forgot that this existed.
No, I mean, I understand why it exists. Again, it's.
I understand why it exists in the same way that you would like. It's effectively they're just like trying to get the audience back, right? It's like,
yeah.
It's
after
like,
all those horrible things. We almost saw a family get murdered by being trapped in a burning home. Phoebus was shot and almost killed with an arrow. Paris is quite literally on fire. And yeah, now we're trying to make sure that we get the audience back.
This feels like a song from Hercules.
Oh, it does. God.
Yeah.
Like the staging, the animation, and the vibe. And
it does feel Hercules, but I'm just...
The playful lyrics.
Maybe I'm just being oversensitive, but I feel like it's almost kind of tasteless because they keep referring back to his physical appearance and stuff. It almost feels like they're patronizing him, like even if they don't mean it. I mean, they're his friends, but yeah. Sorry,
which is the problem,
this song.
No, it doesn't work. And I think you're right, Evan. That's what I was kind of trying to mention earlier, was like, for a film that is trying to get the audience's deepest empathies, to then like, you know, to whiplash you back into you know, like laughing at someone's parents because it's a cartoon.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, is crazy. But yeah. Again, I can watching this again, I'm just sort of like, I get the appeal. Like,
yeah,
it's trying to, like, you want to evoke Frankenstein and like those classic monster movies, you know. But I'm just not in the mood for this song right now.
No. This movie. No. Well, because we had the build up with all of those awful things that Frollo's doing right now, and then we get the very next scene that we get to is, you know, Esmeralda bringing in Phoebus to make sure that he's, oh my god, I forgot the statue's snap. Yeah,
it really feels like they had a test screening. They had a test screening, and like, you know, people started to like twiddle their thumbs at that point, and they were like,
here it is.
Put this in
colors and some lights.
But look at what it actually, look at all the fanfare that we just had. Look what it actually was.
Gone.
Just absolutely gone. Like that, yeah, that's mood whiplash right there. But also, like, it makes you question, like, are they real? Are they really real?
Yeah.
Yeah, and all that thinking is like, oh, of course she likes me. Of course she loves me. It's like,
and
well,
it makes you question Quasimodo's grasp on reality,
isn't
really a question in the rest of the thing. Like, he's actually quite well adjusted.
No, he's
socially.
Yeah, he is.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Like, there's no, like, sort of agoraphobia or, like, social anxiety. It's just sort of, oh, yeah, cool. Come in here. Yeah, put him down there. That's fine.
Yeah, like, he's actually grounded. A grounded character, uh-huh, for the most part. Oh, yeah, also not expected to be in a kid's movie. Sewing up wounds.
Oh, yeah, that's a, yeah.
There's a little bit of blood in there. There's a little blood there.
I think it's the, wow, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Like a,
yeah, right in front of him.
Unrequited, yeah.
Damn it.
You know, I kind of wonder if Quasimodo's, I don't want to use the word infatuation, but I'm going to say it, like, infatuation with Esmeralda,
yeah,
is not really designed to like illustrate any romantic interest at the end of the day, but just kind of his loneliness, because this is the only person that showed him any sort of like physical affection or anything. Mm-hmm. He's never gotten that from, he's never known that before. And I think that kind of explains why he almost like projects that sense of isolation on her. Mm-hmm. You know, she's the only person that he can really cling to, you know.
God, I mean, even movie, if you're breaking my heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a typical like friend zone story, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. Just it like is. Oh, you're nice to me? That's the same as like
being in love, right?
Being in love.
Yeah. In his eyes. Yeah.
We gotta stash the staff.
Oh my god. He's like, I'm not dead yet. I'm getting better.
I still don't quite understand why she brought him there.
Yeah, especially
versus the Court of Miracles. Homeboy's like up there right now, you know. And
yeah, like could discover him any second.
Not very safe.
This is a treat. It's not a treat. What is it like?
He brought him grapes. He brought him grapes. Yeah. It's like, wow, what a treat. You're so kind. Not. Yeah, look, grapes. Like, that's all. Yeah. Oh,
it is a symbol of decadence and.
Yeah, grapes and cheese.
Not sin, but, you know, like, pleasure, I guess.
Mm.
In some sense.
That's a good point, yeah. Seeds.
I love he just kicks him in the face. He's like, shut up. Oh boy.
Damn.
Yeah. Like, like, even if you're like hiding the fact that Phoebus is in there, like, you're already in big doo-doo just by having that, because that's, I mean, look at him. He's, Frollo is triggered right now. I think that's the first time that he's referenced her, at least in this, at least up till now.
I think she came up briefly at the beginning, okay. But he's led Quasimodo to believe that she abandoned him, you mm-hmm. know, and Frodo took him in out of the kindness of his heart.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Accurate portrayal.
Honest guy. Exactly. Exactly. And what a manipulator too. He goes up there and just, you know, like kind of almost baits Quasi into, well, he tells him, I know where they are, you know.
And yeah, and so they try to go warn them, but
yeah,
just using them to find out where they are on his own.
Yeah. Phoebus is up.
Yep.
He was is a little, I don't know what the word is, unkind to unempathetic to Quasimodo as a character.
Yeah.
Not considering like where he's coming from, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well,
he's talking to him like he's one of his men.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good point, Dan. I don't know. Maybe it's intentional, you know, to make it more believable.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I do think he's a pretty good design. I mean, well animated, definitely, but also like a pretty interesting design, Quasimodo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm surprised we hadn't talked about his design yet. Because I'm sure that probably, you know, took them a while to try and figure out in terms of, you know, making him look unique.
But well, also, our main character being Quasimodo, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The armor definitely sets him apart. All the other soldiers have this like very like darker kind of color palette, and he's wearing this like emblazoned like golden breastplate that kind of signals him as like identifies him as the good guy, I guess. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. I don't know if that's a thing. Like do we make associations between color and whether something is good or bad?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely, absolutely. The who's the guy who was dressed in white?
The Archdeacon.
The Archdeacon, yeah. Like, you know, he was absolutely designed as the actual face of Sanctuary, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point.
With that in mind, round features and all the rest of it.
I love that little exchange at the end there.
What is going on?
So they are going to find Esmeralda with the...
what's going on?
Yeah. They're looking for Esmeralda using the trinket that she gave Quasimodo. You hold the city in your hand. Quasimodo has deduced that it's a map of the city. And so they're using it to try and find the Court of Miracles to warn Esmeralda. But of course, because there's romantic tension between Phoebus and Quasimodo and Esmeralda. And okay.
Here's another thing then that's interesting to me. As a kid, that's a pretty complicated plot for me to understand.
Yeah.
And I think I never understood it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, at least as a kid. And that for me is another interesting thing in terms of like the tightrope walk and what audience are really going for. Like already, if you have a plot that's that sophisticated or like, you know, mm-hmm. a point that is that sophisticated in terms mm-hmm. of like what are we, you know, what are we doing here, then mm-hmm. you know, you're already losing the family audience, right? Mm-hmm. You're losing the 5-year-olds, the 6-year-olds, the 7-year-olds.
That's a good point, Dan.
Yeah,
it's probably just, I mean, you've hit on this already. What makes this film kind of frustrating to watch? It's so exhilarating in places, and you just wish it had gone all the way. It's like it just can't quite figure itself out.
Mm-hmm. Can't decide exactly what it wants to be.
Yeah, like, who is this for?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's apparently.
That's exactly the thing. Yeah. But actually, Evan, I think while you were out of the room, I was asking Rach if she had heard the new Broadway version of mm-hmm. this. Have you?
I have, yeah. My community theater back home did it. It was a lot darker than this. Yeah.
But it uses the same score. It's a really interesting thing that they managed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To effectively like course correct and remake it from the same sort of DNA.
Yeah. Well, you talk about its popularity. I think I caught the tail end of that, Dan. So correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was a popular stage musical, because it kind of gives young adults.
Oh, no, it was.
Yeah.
Yes. No, so
it gives us like the film that never was, kind of, you know, you live it through that. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, well, yeah, it was, I think it was a German show. And then it was like, it was on Broadway, I think, for some time.
Oh, wow.
You know, based on the film, basically. But yeah. It was never going to be like, you know, the Lion King or the Beauty and the Beast musical, where they could go for that family audience. I think the thing that's interesting about it is from the start, they were saying, actually, let's make it as dark as it needs to be.
Yeah, like case in point, right here.
Yeah.
What does Frodo want?
What's that?
What does he want? Is this all just for Esmeralda? Like, what is it?
Yeah, I think it is. But he's just so...
Despite.
Yeah.
Some good expressions there on Felix.
I know. So I think that's something that really impressed me when I rewatched this movie. It's like, man, that the character animation is phenomenal on some of the main cast.
And no, I think, so this is the thing I think that we have not really spoken about enough, is that I think it really is a pinnacle of character animation for Disney.
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
With James Baxter leading Quasimodo and Frollo and Felix being like very... And Esmeralda, of course, like being very like realistic.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of their proportions.
Yeah, I think probably the more like probably one of the more realistic 2D animated features in terms of like their human characters.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I wish they'd come back to this. I'd like to see
Me too.
A 2D film every now and then. You don't have to get rid of the 3D, you know, there's a place for that too, but it's been years.
I think that, okay, my hottest take on it is I don't think they know how to do it. I think that there was a certain point at which they lost the opportunity to have sort of like a collective understanding of what needs to be done. And I think individually, animators they might still employ know what to do and all the rest of it, but having a whole studio on board is another thing.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And I would also venture to say, so one of the most interesting things that is on Disney Plus that I will always recommend.
Okay.
This moment always freaked me out as a kid.
Why?
Where the
Sorry,
I'm interrupting my own story to say this moment freaked me out as a kid because the gargoyles turned to stone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a real
on screen.
It's like when it's like when Gonzo and Rizzo are like at the end of Muppet Christmas Carol when they're like, oh, this is too scary for us guys. We'll see you at the finale.
Yeah, I know. It's like, hey guys, we're peacing out.
I thought you were gonna say it's scary because Esmeralda's about to burn to death.
I mean that too.
Looking at the pair down there. that too.
Right? I love the shot of Quasimodo right here. I love it. He's done. This is such he's an so epic done. Scene. He's so done. I love it.
I haven't actually seen the there was a movie from the 30s, was there not, with Lon Chaney as Quasimodo?
I think so, yeah.
I'd be interested how much they cribbed from that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, because, you know, that shot of Quasimodo, he was like a Universal Movie Monster, the way he was sort of backlit. So going back to the documentary, the Frozen documentary.
Okay.
Fascinating. Because most of the movie was done in like the last like 5 months from the looks of it.
Oh yeah. I think I remember hearing about that.
That shot is pretty iconic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Her arms splayed out like she's on the cross.
Yeah.
But
also the camera move as well. I mean, that's the real James Baxter, the showing off shot.
Yeah. Cinematography.
I think the thing is that, so basically, they've gotten so used to making films the way they do now, when in fact so many things can be changed quite late in the game. Whereas in the hand-drawn animation, things have to be locked down a lot earlier.
Yeah.
And I believe that there is a lot of flexibility that they get with CG, that the heads of studio, I think, would find quite hard to deal with. When you look at, you know, how much the animation itself is done, like in the last, like, usually, you know, less than 9 months of actual production.
Mm-hmm.
See, like, a really strange decision there to have the weird like knocking his teeth out shot. Hang on, this sort of like Warner Brothers stuff does not match with the score. It doesn't match with the overall tone of the scene.
Yeah,
it made sense for like, say, like, because you know what vibes I get when I see these kind of things, at least with the gargoyles, like, it makes me think of the scene in Beauty and the Beast in the climax when all the servants of the castle are fighting bats against the invaders.
Yeah.
But the difference there is that they play up the music to be a more of a comedic reprisal of Be Our Guest. But like you said, with this, it's just like complete tonal dissonance in terms of just like, and I forget when it happens, there's a bit where a soldier gets knocked off a castle or something, and you hear the Goofy scream. And I'm like, well, I'm not sure I feel that right now. Oh, right here, we get a reference to Wizard of Oz. My pities fly.
Yeah.
Though I do remember that joke getting a reaction from a lot of the adults in the audience when we saw it in theaters. A lot of the adults were getting a giggle from that. Oh, and apparently Quasimodo just has lava or like melted rock or whatever. Look at this. Like, you just had that on standby.
Yeah. He had a lot of it on standby. You see it blowing out.
Look at Notre Dame. I mean, that, to be fair, that is an incredible shot. That's wonderful imagery.
I feel like that's when it works.
Yeah.
In a way, like, that's the grand operatic, you know, stuff works for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I can imagine watching the most spectacular stage show I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you doofus? This is very King Kong.
Yeah.
'Twas beauty killed the beast.
Oh boy.
That's a good comparison.
Sad little mouth.
Yeah.
But it's a fake out though, because she's not really dead. Spoilers. But I think for people who are familiar with the source material, like, oh no, is this that thing where she dies?
Yeah. Well, for, I don't know, for like parents at least who were watching this, maybe they were trying to tease that a little bit if they'd read the novel. Like, oh my gosh, is it going to end like this?
Mm-hmm. You know? Is it going to have that sad ending?
Yeah. Damn.
Yeah.
This good is pretty heavy.
Oh my God. Like some of the best right there.
Kind of a bit choked up watching it.
I know. So like every single time Quasimodo cries, like I die a little bit inside because like someone that pure should never be crying.
You know, I think
Frollo, I hate you so much.
I love how the red lighting just floods the room as soon as Frollo walks in.
And it's, you see it's that like heralding dagger the behind devil. His back.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I will
your
also
eternal reward.
Yes!
Yes! Yeah. Into something forever.
But then Quasimodo gets the daggers like, oh, I love it. And he's shaking. You can see him shaking as he's holding that.
This isn't my thought, but somebody made a comment a while ago outside of here about how, you know, Quasimodo could have broken free of Frollo at any time because mm-hmm. he's infinitely stronger than him. But mm-hmm. it's the kind of psychological cage he's put him in.
Yes.
That's kept him back. And he breaks free in that moment where he takes the dagger from him. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And you can do what you want.
And now Frollo's actually scared of him.
Yeah.
Even though he's taking swings for him, he's actually like, he realizes it's over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an animator, but
you
guys were talking about the acting and stuff and like the convincing motion. I like how the sword looks heavy when Frollo's
swinging it. Oh yeah, it's
he's this old man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Rachel.
I mean,
no, absolutely.
Yeah, no. The you can't fool the animation at all.
Using his cape, dang.
Mm-hmm. I know, he looks so deliciously evil.
Deliciously evil.
Deliciously evil.
Here he goes.
Oh, dang.
The Alan Rickman angle.
And he doesn't let him go. He could have just let go of him right there.
Yeah, I know, he didn't. You know? He doesn't. That I find that interesting.
He's just too good a person, you know?
Yeah, it's the...
Look at Frollo's eyes.
Oh God!
This is like his true form.
Yeah, his final form.
Teeth are glowing.
Teeth are glowing
yellow as well.
One of the best Disney deaths ever.
Yeah, you love the irony of it because he's saying like he shall smite the wicked and you know send them to hell, and right after he says that, even though he's like directing it at Esmeralda, he's the one who falls.
The gargoyle just its face shifts at him for just that demonic face, and I'm like, man,
yeah,
where's that gargoyle been this whole time?
Yeah, it's a righteous like retribution, right? Kind of mm-hmm. like God sending him to hell almost.
Mm-hmm. And I love that was sweet that she unfortunately like she can't hold on to him, but Phoebus comes in for the save.
Yeah. Phoebus cares.
Yeah, he does care.
Okay.
Aww.
And that's how babies are made.
It's just like, and now you're pregnant.
Yeah.
That's a really sweet moment, though. Like, yeah. Some people could say the ending to this film is cynical because Quasimodo doesn't get what he wants, but that's like the true spirit of love, right? It's not self-seeking, you know? He's mm-hmm. happy because Esmeralda's happy, you know?
Well,
and kids can learn something from that.
And in a way, he still does get his happy ending. Even though he's not getting the girl, he's getting what he's always wanted, which is acceptance, which I think is done absolutely beautifully in the next couple seconds right here.
Yeah.
I love this scene so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, good
POV
shot.
Yeah. I love the way they handled this ending in terms of it cinematically. It's like, hi, you might remember me from the Festival of Fools. It was a interesting time. Yeah, and I just like that she's just like, I'm just going to come up and say hello.
I doubt she threw any cabbages.
No, yeah, she was probably just a spectator.
Yeah.
I guarantee Mom, most Dad, of it.
What are you doing?
Yeah, Dad, that's not nice, Dad.
That is really sweet.
Oh, my God. It gets me every time.
Damn.
Curse you, movie, for making me feel feelings.
The tears be coming.
No. Oh, CG shot with the crowd. CG shot with the crowd.
And Clopin bringing us home.
Yep. Nice little bookend.
Oh, the music in this is so good.
Good reprise. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't need the goggles. The film absolutely works without them.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, agreed. Not very purposeful.
Yeah.
Da 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 da. Oh man.
That when he hits that note at that peak of that crescendo, like, oh, shivers all day.
It gives it. I don't know why it gives me chills.
And of course, we end on this.
Yeah.
Zooming out.
Like, okay, all right. It's you almost spoiled it a little bit there, movie, but you just, at least it was brief.
Oh, shaking the birds off.
Yeah, don't you ever mind.
Yeah, that was annoying.
Yeah.
So this was also, I didn't mention this, it's produced by Donald Hahn, but it's also it was put in motion by everyone's friend Katzenberg.
I think
that's the reason it exists in some sense,
really.
But no, I really, because I think in general, like, this is just a more interesting way to talk about films.
Mm-hmm.
It is an interesting object made of a lot of incredibly accomplished pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even talk about how it adds up as a whole, because it's just so strange.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, certain scenes really work.
Oh, and God, so much.
Yeah.
Animation's amazing, and the, you know, the layout and the background work is incredible. But yeah, it's just it's fascinating. as a thing, because, like, if Disney announced a movie like this next year, like, it just wouldn't make sense, would it?
No.
You know, even with you know, you look at one of the most recent movies, like Raya. Is somewhat off the beaten path when you compare it to other movies from this era, with its, you know, shape, but it's still pretty much in line. You know, everything from, I would say everything pretty much from, like, Tangled onwards has a certain shape.
Mm-hmm.
And Disney have kind of stuck to it. And this is like an entirely different overall shape, I think, this sort of movie. I mean, first of all, it's you know, it's quite 90s with the song that we're listening to and the way how that's produced. But yeah, I wonder when we're going to get another movie like that, that sort of reaches for...
I don't know if we will.
Unfortunately.
That reaches for the sort of, you know, like we were saying earlier, the Prince of Egypt kind of thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we can always keep dreaming, or at least keep hoping that someone will come along and say, hey, let's try this.
Films. Sorry, Dan, go ahead, man.
No, ever. You go for it, man.
No, I was just going to say, like, there might not be a Disney over here, but I do just want to give a nod to the Brits and the Europeans and whatnot, because you look at the kind of content that producers out here put out.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they're much more willing to take risks that come closer to this
kind of
content than what we see from the major studios in America.
That is
maybe I'm, you know, full of it, but yeah.
I'd say you have some, you have ground to stand on. But yeah.
Anyway, but go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
Yeah, no, no, it's interesting. Well, I guess what you're talking about is interesting because it's sort of like at this stage, no one could have made animation outside of Disney. It just wasn't possible. It was far too prohibitively expensive. But in some ways, it's more daring than many films that would be released in America.
God, so much.
I mean, I would say perhaps European, to use a broader brushstroke, films probably have overall more daring sensibility. I think, I mean, it's like any country, really. You know, the good stuff gets exported and no one sees all of the embarrassing Mrs. Brown's Boys and all of that, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, of, you know, a lot of stuff just doesn't really make it out. Like, actually, funnily enough, that was something that I noticed, you know, with Annecy again this year, was just like all of these films that were announced and things like that, that you just, the sorts of things you see at festivals that you just, all right, that's, that, I guess they didn't get picked up in my country because, you know, it's not commercial or whatever. Yeah, what I wanted to ask was just general thoughts.
General thoughts. This movie continues to blow me away every single time I see it. And I still get, like, you know, when you see a movie enough, sometimes it's like you expect those moments that give you those goosebumps to eventually, like, you've seen enough times, like, you, those moments don't hit as much anymore. Yeah. This consistently hits. I'm not sure if that's because I've made an effort to not overwatch it, perhaps, but
that's an interesting argument for that.
Yeah, I don't ever want it to lose that kind of that awe-inspiring splendor that hits me when we get the shots of Notre Dame Cathedral in that first opening sequence, or like when like the more impressive song sequences, like Hellfire. Like I want those moments to always hit. So I don't seek out and watch this movie on the regular, because I think it's just that kind of special of a movie for me, that it has that so much weight.
Yeah. No, I think lots of films benefit from not watching them too much.
For sure.
And I think the animation in this actually impressed me a lot more.
After not having seen, yeah, I was curious to have your thoughts, Dan, since you said it's been years since you've watched it.
Yeah, I mean, I know for a fact that, like, there's no, you know, I can't talk about the animation in it because it's just completely beyond me, beyond my understanding a lot of it. But yeah, it's a very interesting thing to watch 25 years later.
I'm happy it exists. I'm so happy it exists. I'm glad that Disney, even though they couldn't go all the way with it, that they took the dare, that they made the ballsy play to say, okay, we're gonna try and tackle these hard hitting and really dark ideas in our film. And just, you know, just to put it out there, just to say, hey, we're Disney, and, you know, we're experimenting, we're trying new things, we're trying to go for that Oscar, you know. It's like, we've already proven we can compete for the best picture with Beauty and the Beast.
And it's fascinating
that balls to the wall with it.
Their next movie was Hercules.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, which is like entirely different in time.
Yeah, and I remember part of the history of why Hercules came to be, which was, I always find a little funny as to why that particular film exists or why they fought. I'm not sure if it was just a timing thing that it was what came out after Hunchback of Notre Dame, but it was, I always kind of look at Hercules as like the film that, why are their name, the director's name's not coming to me? That Clements, the film that Clements and Musker had to make so that they could get to Treasure Planet.
Yeah, but I mean, they had a take on it, and, mm-hmm. and it was basically, you know, Rocky and Superman and
mm-hmm.
And that stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing I kind of miss a little bit is, like, I wonder if this still happens nowadays to kids. I hope it does.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it applies one-to-one, but what was kind of nice about the Disney movies in the 90s was each of them sort of trying to touch a slightly different culture or mm-hmm. like a country's history. And yeah. as a result, like, as a kid, I was like, oh, I want to learn about Notre Dame because of the movie. Mm-hmm. I want to learn about ancient Greece. I want to learn about ancient China. Like,
right.
there was that nice run, you know, of movies that I think got kids interested a lot in, like, history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so should we wrap it up here?
I think we've talked through a good. Yeah, we've talked through a good bit of the credits.
I can see the person coming now, collecting the the empty popcorn.
Yeah, popcorn box, the popcorn bowls, the empty the soda yeah. soda drinks. Yeah. So I think we're the theater's about to kick us out. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully you've enjoyed watching along with us for the Hunchback of Notre Dame, whatever format you've watched, either on Disney Plus or YouTube or wherever you have access to the film. But yeah, it was a blast getting to rewatch it again, especially with you yeah. guys, and talk about it and all the stuff that I didn't even Same. Know about it beforehand, since I was really... this is one of the few Disney movies I really don't have a lot of background history on. So thank you very much for that, guys.
Yeah, I can't recommend enough that that slash film article, The Oral History. Lots of very interesting people involved in this. Brenda Chapman, one of them.
Mm-hmm. How about we make sure we'll make sure that article is in the show notes for this episode, so that way people can check it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining us. We'll just go around the table here. Do you guys want to plug your social media feeds at all, or we want to just leave that be for now? Because I know we're all kind of having rough relations with the social media at the moment.
I'm happy.
Okay. Where can we find you, Dan?
Oh, no, I'm saying I'm happy not to mention it. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Yep. All right. We'll just do our usual plugs then. Please stay tuned to animationforadults.com for upcoming content, including some awesome interviews conducted by Evan, who's just absolutely been killing it, by the way.
Thanks.
Always continue to support the site and the podcast via checking out our Patreon page and our Ko-Fi page. Stay tuned for what we have coming up next down the pipeline. We will see you next time. Take care.
Your favorite things feel made for you. Your education should too. University of Maryland Global Campus, formerly University of Maryland University College, was made to serve the military and working adults like you. Today, we continue that tradition by offering frequent start dates so you can get started with convenient online learning that fits your schedule, by recognizing your accomplishments with credits you can earn for what you know, by providing no-cost online resources replacing most textbooks because a college education can fit your budget too, and with no SAT or GRE required for most programs. University of Maryland Global Campus, made for you. Last year, we awarded more than $15 million in scholarships to qualified students, including community college students, service members, veterans, and working adults just like you. Discover how we can make your education and your goals for the future a reality. Visit us at umgc.edu. That's umgc.edu. Certified to operate in Virginia by Chev.
I haven't really woken up. Until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's. I'm loving it.